You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, retired U.S. Army officer and former National Security Advisor. In 2005, then-Colonel McMaster commanded the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment during the Battle of Tal Afar in northwestern Iraq, a now widely studied urban counterinsurgency operation. His leadership and strategy used in Tal Afar were praised by senior U.S. officials and widely seen as a model for counterinsurgency. It is truly a great honor to have him on the podcast, as his writing about Sir Michael Howard's sage advice that military history must be studied in width, depth, and context is a driving force behind my case studies of past urban battles and podcasts like this one. Sir, welcome to the show.
Hey, John, great to be with you. And thanks for the great work you do on this podcast and at the Modern Warfare Institute.
Well, thank you, sir. So, sir, what I usually do for episodes like this is that, if you don't mind, I thought I'd give the listeners a quick background refresher on the Battle of Tal Afar to kind of set the stage for our conversation.
All right.
In 2005, the city of Tal Afar in northwestern Iraq, not far from the Syrian border and along an ancient route leading to Mosul and other cities, had become a critical stronghold for insurgent groups, including al-Qaeda in Iraq, and foreign fighters streaming across the Syrian border. The city, with a population of approximately 200,000, mostly Turkmen, but a mix of Sunni and Shia sects, had spiraled into lawlessness following a U.S. withdrawal in 2004. Insurgents used the urban terrain to their advantage, constructing fortified positions, laying extensive IED networks, manufacturing vehicle-borne IEDs, and building safe houses that allowed them to terrorize the population and resist coalition efforts. To reclaim the city, then Colonel H.R. McMaster led the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment in Operation Restoring Rights, a textbook example of urban counterinsurgency. Earlier, from May to August of 2005, the regiment worked to isolate the city, cutting off insurgent lines of communication. Operation Restoring Rights was launched in late summer 2005. The operation unfolded in 3 deliberate phases, shaping the battle space through isolation, to include McMaster's troops spending 3 weeks building a 12-foot-high berm around the city that enclosed 15 square kilometers. There were multiple deliberate population evacuations and targeted raids. Then clearing neighborhood block by block with combined arms teams and holding ground by establishing combat outposts to prevent insurgent reinfiltration. After the operation, the regiment remained in place to build the trust between coalition forces and Iraqi civilians that was essential to providing intelligence and a venue to mentor Army Iraqi interactions with the population. McMaster's regiment was reinforced by Army brigades and supported by elements of the 82nd Airborne Division, 1st Infantry Division, 3rd Infantry Division, making it one of the first large-scale joint operations with Iraqi forces at the brigade level. With around 3,000 American troops and 5,500 Iraqi troops committed to the mission, U.S. estimates placed insurgent strength at around 500 to 1,000 foreign and Iraqi insurgents who employed sniper and RPG ambushes, booby traps to slow the advance, and other guerrilla tactics. But McMaster's strategy emphasized protecting civilians and restoring governance, not just killing enemy fighters. Over 150,000 residents were evacuated prior to the assault beginning to reduce civilian casualties, which remained relatively low despite the intensity of the urban fighter. The operation succeeded in killing over 150 insurgents and capturing almost 600. 8 soldiers were killed and 19 wounded in the battle. In its aftermath, Tal Afar has held up by senior U.S. officials as a model for future urban operations, illustrating how disciplined, population-focused warfare, paired with armored maneuver and persistent presence, could stabilize a city, disrupt insurgent control, and enable a return to governance. Now, sir, does that summary sound about accurate?
Yeah, it does, John. It does. You're bringing back some memories. You know, the great team that we had, you know, across our regiment. As you mentioned, you know, with the White Falcons for the 82nd Airborne Division, we had Special Operations Forces. We had an awesome counter-sniper SEAL team working with us. We had the Special Operations Forces from the Iraqi Army who were hit hard, actually, as soon as they arrived with a vehicle-borne IED. but recovered from that and joined the operation with us. And then the 3rd Iraqi Army Division, as you mentioned. I mean, it was a real team effort. And of course, all the joint capabilities we're able to bring to bear as well. So my friend in the Triple Nickel Engineer Brigade, Bill Rapp, who's a former commandant at West Point there, he sent every bulldozer in Iraq up for us to build that obstacle that you mentioned that isolated the city. So, hey, I mean, we were really the benefit of an awesome teamwork across the whole command there in Iraq.
Amazing, sir. And I want to get to some of those details with the time that we have, but I am curious, as a student of urban warfare, is how much did late 2005, how much did the first and second battles of Fallujah reside in the kind of thinking of American forces at the time?
Yeah, well, we actually wanted to learn as much as we could from those most recent urban operations in Iraq. And so we structured the operation based on the lessons of Fallujah, one in particular, and the importance of getting the civilian population out, but screening them on the way out to greatly reduce the chance that Al-Qaeda members could sneak out of the city. And then from an informational perspective, to make it clear, hey, this isn't an attack on Tal Afar. This is an attack for the people of Tal Afar. It's an attack on Al-Qaeda to lift the pall of fear off of the city and to restore life. So we also learned from an operation in 2004 in Tal Afar, when Al-Qaeda, remember the rolling offensive that came across Nineveh province in 2004 when we greatly reduced our forces there. And then in response to that Al-Qaeda offensive, which had taken over Tal Afar and had threatened Mosul, was an operation called Black Typhoon. And while it was successful in temporarily regaining access to the city, it was, from an informational perspective, problematic, not just because of the name, but also because of effective Al-Qaeda propaganda operations. And so the name of our operation, Restoring Rights, communicated, I think, really the change in the tone of the operation, that we were fighting really for the people of Tal Afar against these enemies of all civilized people, Al-Qaeda, which had brutally attacked the city, choked the life out of the city.
Yes, sir. And I did see that Operation Black Typhoon was in the Army history as the precursor to Tal Afar. I just was interested, even in 2006, later in Ramadi, some of the command discussions were not to repeat a Fallujah situation with the destruction. So that was a very interesting.
And I'll tell you, the 1st Brigade, 1st Armored Division did a fantastic job in Ramadi. And this was Sean McFarland, who initially, when we commanded that brigade, came into Tal Afar, and we transitioned with him. And then the brigade minus went to Ramadi, which was a much larger scale problem, and they did a fantastic job there.
Yes, sir. And I actually was on Navy SEAL retired Jocko Wilnings' podcast, and he had a very formidable experience being the SEAL team support to the Battle of Ramadi.
Okay, John, you're not going to believe this. I did a leader professional development program with SEAL Team 10 yesterday because one of the officers there was a young SEAL fighting with us in Tal Afar in 2005. And so this guy, Joe, asked me, hey, will you talk to my SEAL team over Teams, which I just did yesterday. And they did a fantastic job there. They really did. Al-Qaeda was very sophisticated in their defenses, and they had some really advanced sniper capabilities. One of the Al-Qaeda snipers we killed was a Sudanese who had been very, very well trained. And Al-Qaeda had brought him in specifically for the purpose of killing as many American soldiers as he could.
Wow. That's actually my first question, sir, is what did you walk into when you found and arrived in Tal Afar? What was the enemy situation and what were the conditions like for the local population?
Well, we initially deployed into South Baghdad, and our mission was to operate and to conduct area security, counterinsurgency operations, defeat the enemy in South Baghdad, the so-called Triangle of Death area, an area that had been unresourced for quite a while and had become kind of a haven and support base for Al-Qaeda, where they assembled suicide bombers, truck bombs, for the onslaught into Baghdad, in large measure to attack U.S. forces, but also Shia communities, to keep going the cycle of sectarian violence that was allowing Al-Qaeda to create a chaotic environment, and then to use that chaotic environment to try to establish control of territory and establish the caliphate. So we began operations there, and almost as soon as we got there, we were diverted by General Casey, the theater commander, to Nineveh province. The regiment minus our 3rd squadron, which we left in contact with some other elements to reinforce them in South Baghdad, to go to western Nineveh province, where it was clear that the 220 or so kilometers of border were not secure and that Al-Qaeda was easily transiting that area and then using Talafer essentially, you know, as the Fort Benning, Georgia of the insurgency, a training area where they would organize, train, and equip terrorist cells, including, you know, suicide bombers, snipers, roadside bomb teams. They were teaching courses, you know, like kidnapping and murder. It was a course they were teaching. They were also teaching, you know, first aid, information operations and propaganda. And after you completed the course, you were issued, you know, your satellite comms and your cameras and so forth. So it was important in the view of General Casey to take back Talafer and then to secure the border and ensure that Al-Qaeda could no longer kind of reconstitute the insurgency through these, you know, these infiltration routes, rat lines that went into Syria. And of course, to move up there, I give a fragmentary order to our second squadron, commanded by a great officer named Chris Hickey. And he immediately initiated movement up in Talafer. You know, his first movement into the airfield outside of Talafer, which would become our main base. Along that road, he was hit by six IEDs, you know, on his way in. And so he had a lot of learning to do. There was a striker cavalry unit, a very capable unit there, but they were overwhelmed in terms of the scope of their responsibilities. So Chris immediately got up there and he started what he called Operation Cold Fusion, which was to conduct, you know, what we do in the cavalry, reconnaissance, right? Reconnaissance of the physical terrain of the enemy, but also, you know, the human terrain to understand what the drivers of conflict were. So Chris and the 2nd Squadron got about a month start on the rest of the regiment. And we continued to fight in South Baghdad to go after the enemy there and prepare for the transition to the mission up in Nineveh province. And so he was already doing what you would expect a cavalry squadron commander to do, developing situational understanding for us. And as the regiment got there, then we began to obviously bring more resources to bear and to allocate missions to the squadrons to have the overall effect, as you mentioned in the introduction, you know, to isolate the insurgency from sources of strength and support, especially across the border. And then to begin to conduct effective counterinsurgency operations to defeat the enemy in the area of operations, while we're also at the same time building Iraqi security forces and to set conditions for sustainable security and stability there.
Sir, there's a lot there that we could do separate podcasts on. I've read a lot of your work about the importance of armored cavalry, of reconnaissance on the modern battlefield, even my own experiences in the Battle of Sadr City and how getting to the objective. We kind of fast forward to everybody's on the objective, but all that reconnaissance that you're talking about that had to be done and the fight for intelligence that has to be done, even in urban terrain. So much there, sir. I know it's something that you've written a lot about. And of course, I met you years ago when you're at Fort Benning leading that charge in those transformations to keep that as a very high priority in our transformation.
Yeah, John, I think we're taking a step back on that, sadly. You know, I think that what we're learning, you know, and what you're helping us learn with the great work that you're doing, the field work and the research and the writing that you're doing, is that, you know, reconnaissance is more important than ever. You know, it's so there's this idea these days that remote systems, which are growing, you know, in terms of capability, whether it's low Earth orbit, unmanned aerial systems, unmanned ground systems, various electronic intelligence collection capabilities, like RF collection and so forth, are going to give you perfect situational understanding and ability to target from long range. But of course, as we're seeing, and I think you would agree with this, you know, there are still traditional countermeasures. You can employ dispersion, concealment, intermingling with civilian populations and deception, as well as technological countermeasures that will still, I think, make it necessary to develop situational understanding in close contact with the enemy. And to do that, you need combined arms, you know, and no arm can be decisive on its own, right? The Russians figured out, like, if you drive tanks on roads, you know, toward urban areas, you get blown up. But also it's true that if you're an infantry formation in urban terrain, you need mobile protected firepower along with your fires capabilities and everything else you can bring to bear. So anyway, I hope we're keeping that focus on combined arms and also, you know, the need to fight for information, John, you know, in close contact with the enemy. And oftentimes an enemy that's interspersed with civilian populations.
Absolutely, sir. I mean, your work on your fallacies that I've taken and rewritten and tried to convince people, there are some inherent fallacies here in people's thinking about how the fight will go. And I do all this work around the world, going to urban areas, going, it didn't go like that. Like you said, even the Russians' thoughts of what they would do in Kyiv failed when it got into the close fight and trying to find routes to where they were trying to get and all that reconnaissance that's there 100%. I'm seeing it everywhere in the world. The urban terrain is that somewhat equalizer. It's not the great equalizer, as some people say, but it is an equalizer to degrade some of those advanced technologies. And if you come without a full combined arms team, so many lessons over and over again learned. You can't separate the armor from the infantry, from the fires, from the intelligence, all of it. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Hey, John, I think close combat overmatch is still super important, right? We need all the long-range capabilities, tiered and layered air defense, long-range precision fires. These are absolute requirements to be effective. We need a whole range of capabilities to blind our enemies, right? Because of the increasing transparency of the battlefield. But close combat overmatch, I think, is as important as ever, you know? And I'm thinking about an old monograph that was published out of Fort Knox, Kentucky, when it was still the home of armor, called To Fight or Not to Fight, about reconnaissance and the degree to which you need, you know, mobile protected firepower, for example, as part of reconnaissance formations. And the trend has always been like, in peacetime, we talk ourselves out of it, you know? And then in wartime, we're like, oh man, we need combined arms reconnaissance formations.
Yes, sir. Okay, I knew this would happen, sir. And so back to Talifar, because the urban terrain, it's the urban triad, the people, the terrain, and the infrastructure. When you were planning the operation in such a dense and ethnically divided urban environment, like we see around the world, I mean, they're not single organisms. Often there's shared power structures, clans, tribes, sects, especially in Tal Afar, with a reputation of being an insurgent stronghold. How did you approach that in your planning?
Well, first of all, there have been people who had been there before. So the 101st Airborne Division had been there. So we contacted their leadership. We got online with them. They helped us, you know, understand what they had learned during their year in Tal Afar. I called the history department at West Point where I had taught. And I said, hey, do you guys have anybody there who knows anything about Nineveh province and northern Iraq? And there was a guy there named Major Dan Bernard, who had just finished his doctoral degree at University of Chicago. And he had written on the insurgency against the British in Nineveh province in the 1920s. I'm like, oh, okay. How soon can he get here? So he arrived. He sent us tribal maps, you know, from Columbia University's library that actually were still quite relevant to the area. And then he helped us learn enough about the area to go in and ask the right questions, you know. And then, John, what you've got to do is you've got to meet the local leadership there, right? The Mukhtars and the Sheikhs, and talk to them about how they understand the conflict, how they've been affected by it. And this, of course, was the Shia population who was beleaguered by Al-Qaeda, that was in kind of a rump area of the city on the southwest part of the city and was defending itself, but also included kind of the police force, which was kind of a crazy situation. You had a Shia leader of the police force, a guy named Colonel Ismail, and all the Sunni members of the Sunni Turkmen in particular from the police force had all gone away because Al-Qaeda came and they said, hey, if you're in the police force, we're going to kill your family. You know, so they had no option but to dissolve. But then what that led to, because of the atrocities that Al-Qaeda committed on the Shia population, is the Shia police force began to really be driven by retribution, you know? And so they would wander out of this 16th century Ottoman castle every night and just kill a bunch of Sunni males. And it was driving this cycle of sectarian violence that was tearing the city apart and continuing to empower Al-Qaeda, because then Al-Qaeda could portray themselves as patrons and protectors of the Sunni population. So the first thing I did was, as I learned about this, is I called my friend, a parliamentarian in the Iraqi parliament, Haider al-Abadi, who later became prime minister of Iraq. And when I was national security advisor, we reconnected. And I said, Haider, this guy, Colonel Ismail, I understand he had like 5 members of his family killed by Al-Qaeda. I understand what's driving him, but he's not a force for good up here right now. So Haider had him promoted to brigadier general, moved to Baghdad. And then I worked with the governor and others to get appointed a man named Najm Abid Abdullah al-Jabouri as the police chief. Fantastic guy. Seen kind of as neutral because he was a Sunni Arab from the Jabouri tribe, which is an old tribe there. He had military experience, was well respected. And the guy is like, you know, he's a humanist. You know, he's a fantastic human being. And that guy began to reform the police force. Now, you know, at the same time as he's doing that, we have an Al-Qaeda sympathizer mayor. You know, that sounds kind of crazy, right? But the Al-Qaeda sympathizer mayor's brother was running much of the Al-Qaeda operation in the eastern part of the city, the really dense urban terrain of the city, the Sarai district. And so, you know, we needed to get rid of that guy, you know? And so we actually arrested his brother. And then I just had to have a conversation with him. Hey, you know, I think we might be arresting you next. unless maybe you can move to another place, like maybe move into Turkey or something. Then he left. Najmi becomes the mayor. Meanwhile, we're talking to all the sheikhs and the Mukhtars, trying to understand the drivers of conflict. But what in doing so, we emphasize kind of like our common humanity and the fact that these Al-Qaeda murderers were the enemies of all civilized peoples. And you know, we talked about our children. Like I met with them in Al-Kisik, which was the headquarters of the 3rd Iraqi Army Division, which had collapsed during the Al-Qaeda offensive, and we were in the process of reconstituting. And I just began by talking about how beautiful the children were, you know, in this part of Iraq, and how we want to work with them so that they could ensure that their children have a future that's secure and safe and so forth. So we began to build those relationships and then listening to people like, what are you upset about? Well, we think we have a Shia government in Baghdad that doesn't represent our interests, you know, and we don't have a say. Well, hey, did any of you vote in the last election? No, we couldn't. Well, why is that? Because Al-Qaeda would have killed us. Okay. Well, we began to trace all these grievances back to Al-Qaeda. Boy, it'd be nice to have some like clean water in the city. Well, we tried to do that. You know, we contracted people to deliver clean water. Guess what? Al-Qaeda blew up the trucks and shot the drivers, you know? So, you know, whose fault is that, that you don't have electricity and water? Well, we'd like the schools back open, which have been closed for over a year. Well, why aren't the schools open? Well, because Al-Qaeda is using the schools as a training base, you know, for these classes that I mentioned, you know, kidnapping and murder. And this is where they were housing suicide bombers, you know, giving them the Islamist pep talk before they sent them out to commit mass murder. So, you know, we began to trace those grievances back to the population and then developed a plan, like with them, with the Iraqi Army Division, with Mayor Najm and the new police chief who came in also from the Jabori tribe, to develop an operation, Operation Restoring Rights, which had at its center the destruction of Al-Qaeda in Tal Afar, but had, you know, a whole range of activities and operations that we conducted to set conditions for that first. Securing the border, disrupting their infiltration networks across this 22,000 or so square kilometer area of operation, working with our Marine brothers to the south who are down in Al-Qaim in an area that also that was in our area of interest that affected us as well, reforming the security forces, racing to develop infantry close combat competencies within the Iraqi army, which they would need inside of Tal Afar, task organizing, where we had Iraqi army brigades, you know, supported by training with ODAs from our special forces, and then also paired with our cavalry squadron. So a cavalry squadron paired with an Iraqi brigade, working with their headquarters to help develop their competencies and their logistics, you know, getting them the equipment and weapons and communications capabilities that they needed. So this is all going on between May and September when Operation Restoring Rights really kicks off with a major urban operation. And then we're also bringing into the team an infantry formation, which I had to argue kind of stridently for. You know, I think I upset maybe some people in my chain of command because General Casey, I think, overruled my division of corps commander to send the White Falcons, 2nd of 325, under Chris Gibson. What a fantastic unit they were, man, because we needed skilled infantry to operate with us. The operation itself also included, and the planning for it, what comes next. You know, we had everything lined up from, you know, transformers to reestablish electricity. We had already hired, worked with Iraqis and the governor. We'd already hired the teachers, had all the instructional materials ready to go to reopen the schools, contracted for the reconstruction of, you know, everything from, you know, police stations to the city parks, you know. And what we wanted to do is once we crushed Al-Qaeda there, we wanted to restore life almost immediately and make clear with the stark choice, right, between an Al-Qaeda run place and a place where people can live and feel secure. So it was a major planning effort. I think it was extremely well executed by all members of the team who I mentioned. And of course, it wasn't without cost and risk. We lost some courageous, fantastic soldiers and officers in this fight, but we were able to inflict staggering losses on Al-Qaeda in large measure because Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda at the time, didn't want to give up the place. It was too valuable to him. So he said, we will defend to the last man. And of course, I'm thinking, great, you know, that's what we were hoping you would say. And then we began, you know, the effort to isolate the city, to control movement in and out. Then that phase, we conducted a series of offensive operations in the city, which gained greater intelligence about the enemy's stronghold, you know, in the Sarai district, for example. And then we worked, you know, outside in the towns around Tal Afar. And then ultimately in early September, you know, kicked off the major offensive operation into the city.
Sir, there's so much there. How heartened I am by the planning that went into it, as I even teaching in urban warfare course to division commands about understanding the city is more than just understanding the terrain, as in the physical terrain, but that human terrain. Clearly, Tal Afar is a case study in your planning going into the operation. One of the things that I think I find, and especially with Sir Michael Howard's use and abuse of history when it's misapplied, Tal Afar is often described as one of the quintessential modern examples of clear hold build. I understand the nuances of that, but I've wrestled with a lot of people that apply it to kind of all fights in different phases. Could you explain how you implemented that on the ground? Because I know how extensive you went into clearing and the frustrations and sometimes challenges of evacuating the city in preparation for the high intensity portion of the overall operation. And you just discussed some of the elements of holding and building. And I know like power is back up and running in a week and the schools were reopened in a week. But how do you view that clear, hold, and build? Was that the way you articulated it at the time in this battle?
Yeah, that was a phrase that really brought back into use by Andy Krepinevich, who wrote an essay around the same time as our operation, I think, or maybe just before. And then Phil Zelikow, who was the counselor at the State Department, who Condoleezza Rice had sent out on like a fact-finding mission. And I talked with him, even though people were trying to keep him away from me. And then he prepared her testimony in which she, Condoleezza Rice, Secretary Rice, highlighted that as I think it's a useful kind of heuristic, you know what I mean, John? But of course, you know, there's, as you alluded to already, there's a lot more that goes into it than just, you know, three steps, you know. And so in this case, what we wanted to do is really disrupt their ability to come across the border, which I think we did very effectively, very quickly. Our first squadron had that mission under a guy named Greg Riley, who's just a great combat commander, that guy, you know. Like, he's one of these guys, like, if you say, hey, you know, could you detach this unit to, you know, to second squadron, this is right before the operation. And he's like, sure, but like, what do you want that unit to do? And, you know, I described it to him and he's like, well, I think you need more than that. And he just gave up more of his organization and more assets to task organize them effectively. So a tremendous team player, did a great job disrupting from Sinjar, his base in Sinjar, across the border. But then we wanted to isolate the insurgency within the city, you know? And so I mentioned the berm. We dug a 14-foot berm around the entire city. We only left three routes in and out. We put informants along with Iraqi security forces and our forces at those points, and informants would flag if they saw somebody who was a terrorist or suspected terrorist. We can then detain and gather information and evidence on. And so that began to disrupt them, began to disrupt their ability to resupply themselves or to reinforce themselves and so forth. But then, as you mentioned, it was hard to get people to evacuate because Al-Qaeda wanted to keep the civilians there as shields, right? Which is why, you know, we see kind of the tragedy in Gaza, right? I mean,
yes, sir.
Gaza is the only historical example I'm aware of, John, where the civilian population has been prevented from evacuating, you know?
Yes, sir.
And I think if there's ever going to be any remedy to that humanitarian catastrophe, the Egyptians need to freaking open up to the Sinai, get the international community. Anyway, that's a digression, but—
Oh, it's an important digression, sir. And I'm not a historian. I know, sir, you taught history. I, of course, deal with it. I can't find another case study where there is one single country with one single exit point that says, no, nobody can come out no matter if they want to or not. It's unique.
And that's really what has to give there, I think, in terms of, you know, the plight of the Palestinian people, because of course, you know, Israel doesn't have an option other than to destroy Hamas and to get these hostages back. We'll see what happens with the ceasefire anyway. But in Tal Afar, of course, Al-Qaeda does what they do all the time. They're using the population as human shields. And so I gathered the Mukhtars. I gathered them in an old British fort between Tal Afar and Mosul, where one of our tank companies was based. And the Mukhtars arrived, and I just kind of, you know, I was really tough on them. I said, hey, if you don't evacuate your people, the blood is going to be on your hands. You need to get them moving today. And so we extended the deadline for about 48 hours, and people began to move. And once people begin to move, right, you know, it was too much for Al-Qaeda to deal with. And then some of the worst of the worst in Al-Qaeda, like a beheader, somebody who would serially abused young boys and sodomized them, right? This guy was just, you know, a paragon of evil, right? He's walking out dressed as a woman. But, you know, Iraqi security forces, you know, they're savvy, right? They're like, something's not right with that. He was holding the hands of children he had coerced to hold his hands. And so they saw something wrong with that. So we captured that guy. And then what we did is, as we evacuated people through, they went through a tent. And in the tent was a screen. And behind that screen were informants, a panel of informants, who looked at the faces of each individual coming through. If they identified as a suspected terrorist, they would raise their hands. And then we would ask them to write a statement about that individual. That individual exited out a different tent door and went into temporary detention while we gathered intelligence and then began to screen that individual. And so we took a lot of care to do that before the operation. But then we had a continuous effort in the towns around us. Mamadia was one, another town to the west whose name is escaping me, which was known as kind of an Al-Qaeda transit point. We had everybody in the fight, John. You know, so in one That's of these cases, man. As we kick off the operation, our maintenance troop, combined with an Iraqi police company, isolates this town. They go in and they hand out, you know, frozen chickens and Beanie Babies, right, to the population. As they're doing that, they're taking pictures of every male in this town. We flew them back on a flash drive, back to a panel of informants. We flew them back on a 58, back to a panel of informants who went through all the photos. And again, raising their hands, taking statements. And then we kept the place isolated, went in the next morning and arrested those who had been identified by our informants and had statements and had evidence packets. So it was a continuous effort to ensure that Al-Qaeda couldn't escape, right? And that we could do maximum damage to the organization, not only in the city of Talafer, where they were defending, but also in the surrounding towns.
Yes, sir. And that makes me think of, now I've been into Gaza now 4 times, observing the IDF operations, an immense challenge, a historic challenge. In the beginning, they just did evacuations, basically standing on the side of the road, speaking in Hebrew, hoping that basically if there was a hostage there, that way they'd pop up. As they evolved and learned, they started deploying facial recognition stations and filtering people through those stations. They've done call outs of hospitals and using that facial recognition, very similar tactic as Al-Qaeda, with Hamas members dressed as patients carrying babies and using that facial recognition, which I didn't have in Iraq. I had books of bolo cards, but your use of that local intelligence that's amazing. I didn't know that part of the battle, sir.
Yeah, we just started getting to some of the biometric capabilities in around this time, and we're gathering that on some of these individuals.
I can't let the former commanding general of the Maneuver Center of Excellence, Tanks Bradley's, go without asking, in the fight, sir, in the prepared defense, once the city was evacuated of as much of the civilian population as you could, how did that armored capability, those Bradleys, those tanks, support your urban operations? Were there adaptations that you and your unit had to make based on the terrain and the enemy tactics?
Absolutely. And so, of course, what we need is you need armor to help infantry get across danger areas first, right? And, you know, mobile protected firepower helps you do that. And so there was an area like in the south part of the Sarai district, just for example, in the opening stage of the battle, where Al-Qaeda was defending, you know, forward in these buildings that overlooked a cemetery. And so it was kind of a machine gun swept, you know, terrain. And we had, you know, we had tank crews, you know, who fired, you know, 20, 30 rounds per tank crew, you know, into these buildings, which had the effect of, you know, suppressing the enemy and then allowing us to then move our infantry behind the armor into the urban area. And then, of course, as you know, John, you know, once you get into that urban area, you need the infantry to also support your mobile protected firepower, your tanks and Bradleys, and gain the vertical dominance that you need to be, then cover your move to the next group of buildings. And so we rehearsed, you know, in a lot of detail, infantry working together with mobile protected firepower and our aviation capability. And John, our aviation capability, our Apaches were operating at 5,000 feet. They couldn't be seen or heard. But, you know, we could see very well down into the alleyways and everything else. And when we kicked off the operation, what we wanted to do was just overwhelm the enemy from the beginning. And so, John, I think we used every weapon in our inventory, right? We had actually put up concertina wire around the Sarai district to keep the enemy in, you know, so we could kill or capture all of them. And we had our Predator battery, which had our Humvee-mounted air defense systems, the Avenger systems with quad 50 cals, you know, covering that area, who opened up. Because, again, remember, we have the civilians out of that area. We had tanks of Bradleys opening up against known enemy positions that we had scouted out or identified, you know, with surveillance capabilities from the beginning. We fired GMLRS basically because we could from Sinjar, you know, into where we thought the enemy's headquarters was, took down their headquarters. But then at the same time, we shut down their comms. And John, when we shut down their comms, what did they do? They had to gather somewhere. So they start gathering in these alleyways. And when they gather in the alleyways, we put an HE frag Hellfire missile on top of every one of those gatherings. We went through our entire basic load with our attack troop, entire basic load of HE frag Hellfires. We flew in an emergency resupply.
Wow.
Then, John, as the operation kicks off, we turn the comms back on. The first intercept we got was, "We are being slaughtered," right? And then they're talking about, "Where's this guy? He's dead. Where's that guy? He's dead. Where's that guy? He's dead." And so they're like, "We need to get together," is what they're saying, "to reestablish the chain of command." So then we surveil them. You know, we surveil the city, obviously, continuous surveillance on the city. And we see a gathering happening in a wing of a school. And of course, this is the leadership meeting to reestablish the leadership. So we put a 500-pound laser-guided bomb from F-16 into that school, wing of the school, but it was a dud, you know, which is very unusual, you know?
Oh, man.
But what the dud did is it got all their security details to run into the building. And the next bomb was not a dud, John. You know, so it's sort of,
wow.
It just wiped out the second tier of their leadership then was gone, you know?
Wow.
And so then we began to get a lot of surrenders as we continued to the offensive operation. And then, of course, you know, once Sarai was secure, we had the Qadisiyya neighborhood, which was a sprawling mixed neighborhood, and a series of actions there where our first squadron, again, Greg Riley and his team, essentially we had half cavalry troops, right? Six Bradleys, four tanks plugged in to an Iraqi army battalion. So you had mobile protected firepower, Iraqi infantry, and we also had very effective ODA, Operational Detachment Alphas, from Special Forces plugged in to those Iraqi army battalions. So, you know, I don't want to make it sound easy. This was really hard fighting, you know, and
yes, sir.
And as you know, I mean, body armor, you know, weapons, ammo, right? In difficult urban terrain like that, it's not easy. And our troopers, U.S. troopers, Iraqi troopers did a fantastic job.
Yes, sir. I mean, that's amazing. This is what I fight sometimes in explaining the different case studies of the past is the misconception that, of course, Clearholden builds success in many eras of time, even in urban terrain, very effective in the counterinsurgency principles, foundations like protecting the population, but doesn't mean that once you get into clearing the enemy entrenched and embedded in the dense urban terrain, that isn't an extremely lethal.
Oh, yeah. You still have to kick the enemy's ass, John. Absolutely. You know what's right? I mean, absolutely.
Yes, sir. And I think people take Tal Afar and they believe that that didn't happen. Like, how do you get to that conclusion that you don't think that it was highly destructive, destroying enemy forces?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you. I mean, I hate to, I mean, this is a terrible thing that Hurricane Katrina happened at the time, but I was kind of glad it happened.
You know, information operations, absolutely. First Battle of Fallujah, right?
Yeah, the press arrived as life was returning to the city. You know, we had a couple guys. There was a guy named Michael Ware from Time Magazine there reporting with this also very courageous Italian combat photographer. But, you know, it just tells you the state of the media back then, man. I mean, they were so against the war that the story that Michael Ware filed was heavily edited into a criticism of the Bush administration policy.
Wow.
Right? Instead of telling the story. And to the extent, and this is really just stomach turning, this photographer, he took thousands of photos, you know, during the operation. And the photo they selected for the cover of Time magazine covering the battle was not any one of the photos he took. It was a photo looking down on a soldier in a courtyard, and the soldier looks disoriented.
Wow.
Was not even one of our soldiers, not from our operation. So when the photographer is incensed about it, says, "What the hell? How come you didn't use one of my photos?" You know what the editor told him? He said, "All of your photos made American soldiers look too heroic." Can you believe that? So,
I can actually believe it, sir. Which brings me, I know we only have a few minutes left, sir, but I have to ask you, as somebody who lived those experiences and many others, as somebody who studies urban conflict for a very long time myself, of course, I've been in the Gaza. It's been at the topic globally. What parallels do you see with Battle of Tal Afar and some of the urban complexities of Gaza?
God, well, you know, there are a lot of them. Of course, Gaza, I think, is much more difficult, as I mentioned, because you can't get the civilian population out of there. The other thing is, too, you know, we had very capable Iraqi security forces, which had a high degree of legitimacy with the population, especially after the reform of the police. And there was a political order there, right, with somebody who was a really charismatic, fantastic leader. I mentioned Najm Abed Abdullah al-Jabouri. And so none of those factors are there, right? So that makes Gaza, like, much harder, you know. Also, there's the scale issue, right? Tal Afar, I think 200,000, 250,000 people. And Gaza, what is it? 3 million, is it?
2.1, sir.
2.1 million. Okay. It's not a magical number, you know, but the differences, as I mentioned, you know, in terms of, you know, not being able to get the civilian population out of there is critical. So there are a lot of differences, but, you know, I think the fundamental observation that was critical in Tal Afar is true for Gaza, right? That as long as a terrorist organization has the guns,
yes, sir,
there is no space for an alternative political order to emerge. Because who's going to be the mayor of Gaza, man? Any position you put your hand up, you know, you get a bullet in the head.
They've chopped heads already, like you said.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Absolutely, sir. I mean, I'm trying to help people understand those. Everybody wants a comparison. Like, there is a point where a comparative analysis fails in providing a like example, although those individual parallels are there, and that's that with depth and context that you have to do when you're comparing case studies. And I'm trying to help people with that, sir.
Hey, John, quickly on this. One of the things that was really relevant to us, of course, much different, was the Malaysia campaign and the degree to which police forces were integrated with army, were integrated with the political leadership, and they were working as one. So we're talking about clear and holding, right? The holding part was establishing patrol bases around the city, connecting cavalry troop patrol bases with Iraqi army battalion patrol bases and police force that was reconstituting for a few months. And then to have integrated intelligence between the three of them, to have the kind of routines where you're sharing intelligence briefings, because Al-Qaeda tried to come back in, you know, they tried to come back in, but we had a very well-developed informant network by that time. And we could act to preempt their ability to come in. In most cases, they conducted a devastating attack on a police recruiting line. You know, they used a 13-year-old mentally disabled girl holding the hand of a 4-year-old mentally disabled girl, had strapped them with explosives. I mean, these are horrible people, right? So there were setbacks, there were attacks, but we were largely able to preempt their ability to come back into the city. And one of the days like we knew that we had won, John, was when we had a UAS over a particular neighborhood. A terrorist was putting in a roadside bomb. An older woman came out with a broomstick and began to beat him over the head. I thought, okay, I think now the population feels like they can own their own security. So anyway, I just wanted to talk about that hold phase as critical.
Absolutely, yeah. There's no hope for anything surviving or the old power reemerging if you're not holding the ground and doing those vital phases after you've taken the guns. They'll still try to be the power, 100%, sir. And Tal Afar is an amazing case study of that, given all the context and that immense amount of planning and execution that you and your entire joint force did in that operation, sir.
Thanks, John. I would tell you, I'm proud of all our troopers and what they did. And I mentioned we had fantastic squadron commanders, Iraqi division commander, mayor. I mean, it was a real team effort and lots of support, obviously, from our division and corps and everybody.
Yes, sir. Well, I really appreciate the time. It's been a great honor. This will be an amazing addition to the collection of the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, John. Hey, thanks for the great work you're doing. I learned a ton from it, and please keep it up.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.